The word crime, you think of street crime, violence, wars, rape, street crime, etc. Welfare, poor people, standing in line. And regulation government. Now, there'd be a good debate here at the law school in the following proposition. Resolve that corporate behavior results in far more preventable crime, violence, welfare disbursements, and regulation than either people or governments. If you look at homicide, it was less than 20,000 last year, lower than prior years, still bad. Street homicide, preventable corporate crime and negligence, tens of thousands of lives more. Occupational death, disease, asbestos type diseases, lead contamination, product defects, just in the area of medical malpractice. Over here at the Harvard School of Public Health, the physicians with no axe to grind estimated 80,000 deaths a year just in hospitals, not emergency rooms, clinics, or doctor's offices. This is the crass type of medical negligence. This is not adverse effects. And that sum, which is the lowest estimate of that research group, is more than the combined deaths by motor vehicles, homicides, and fire annually in the country. Not to mention the assault on the biosphere and the consequences for that, forests, ocean, air, water, soil, greenhouse effect. Not to mention the horrific risks if the law doesn't catch up with genetic engineering. Not to mention the destruction of human possibilities when the law services raw wealth and power instead of disciplines them. So where do we all fit in here? We all have a sense of injustice. It just needs cultivating, and it needs to be tendered to our professional skills, talents, and temperaments. Will we get a chance? Will we get a chance? Will we deploy ourselves in this way? Will we think about it while we're at law school, when you have some time, some space, without the senior partner breathing down your neck, some opportunity to engage in elective thinking with your fellow students and your professors? A lot of law professors around the country bewail how conservative the students are. It isn't really the right word. The right word is not conservative. The right word is limited horizons and expectations for maximum returns in a material sense under the pressure of debt. Now let me ask you, how many of you have ever heard of this man's name and what he's done? Willard Hurst. Willard Hurst. Anybody? Okay. How many of you have heard of Roscoe Pound? How many of you haven't heard of Roscoe Pound? All right, now how many of you have read anything by Roscoe Pound? Okay. How many of you are taking or intend to take, because there's a lot of 1Ls here. How many 1Ls are here? Right. The rest are out being interviewed. Getting $10 desserts. Tickets to the opera. The massage. How many intend to take a course in legal history? Okay. Let me hope that all of you will. How much would you know about yourself if all you knew was the last 12 months? Legal history provides context. It provides the wherewithal for you to understand your more technical courses in a broader fashion. It gives you motivation. You understand the struggle for justice, among other parts of legal history. You understand how contract law developed, how the corporate institution emerged from the early corporations in Massachusetts in the early 19th century, and how the charter was restricted and renewed and considered a subject of deep concern by people who wondered what this Frankenstein was that they were creating in their midst. It was a subject of debate right through Brandeis days. Willard Hurst was probably one of the top legal historians in our century. He taught at University of Wisconsin Law School, and he passed away very recently. And he wrote a number of books on legal history. See, not one person in this room And you'll find your upper class people too. They've never heard of it. A lot of people in lower grade law schools, let's call them, don't take jurisprudence, they don't take legal history, they don't take the broader subjects because they want to pass the bar. And law school to them is take every course that will help you pass the bar. Well, that shouldn't operate here at the law school. You're beyond that. You have the luxury of developing curriculum choices in terms of your own non-pragmatic but intellectually fulfilling pretensions. I mean, the bar exam is eminently crammable. You know that, in more ways than one. You take a cram course, you know, and it's shoo-in. You just take that 6-week or 8-week cram course, and that's all they want to do is get you to get through the bar, and that's it. You don't distort the curriculum. Now the question is, how much time do you have to devote to broadening out the curriculum for the students who come after you, to establish a sense of legacy, just like things are better at the law school because of your students who came before you? How much time are you going to devote to that? And second, what's your role as a citizen law student here on campus and off campus? I am struck by, in Washington, one major eruption of concentrated power abuse after another, and the law schools are not in it. They're not commenting, they're not demonstrating, they're not petitioning. And that's why now, with the Appleseed Project and the clinical program that Richard Parker is the professor advisor on, is bringing the students more, not just into legal service. You've got a lot of clinics for legal service. I understand you have 31. But into structural, systemic, mental work by law students. In this case, the architecture of a more just campaign finance system. This is what you should go for. We got in several states laws establishing residential utility rate groups to deal with electric, telephone, gas companies by a bill that was drafted by Harvard Law students in your legislative drafting program. We took the bill, which we helped the students on. We took the bill, got it through the Wisconsin legislature, Illinois legislature, San Diego City Council, and it was ready to sweep the country, except for an atrocious 1986 Supreme Court decision that ruled that laws compelling utilities to insert in their monthly statement at no cost to themselves, postage or otherwise, a little envelope opens up and invites people to join their own statewide consumer group funded by their own annual dues, was so provocative that it violated the corporation's First Amendment rights by violating its right to remain silent. This is not even a person in human terms, a regulated artificial entity monopoly. And that blocked it for the time being. But I'm trying to give you some examples of systemic approach in contrast to necessary legal charity for the poor, for tenants, for immigrants, for others. That's very sensitizing, it's very good, but it can lead you to a burnout situation if you don't move towards systemic assaults on the causes with all the tools that the law offers you. Now I want to conclude on the law school itself. When I was at the law school, we hardly paid any attention to the administration. We were otherwise oriented, and we didn't know anything about how the law school was run. The law school has a $713 million endowment. It's raised about $200 million in its latest extended fund drive, exceeding the $150 million target. You're getting a lot of new facilities, modern library, it's all over. It's full of detours here as you wind your way through the campus. I revert back to the question of Robert Hutchins. What is the purpose of Harvard Law School? Other than a good technical education, a good technical level of scholarship production, an occasional crusading and iconoclastic professor, other than extreme amount of moonlighting by professors for various corporate and other interests, other than providing you with wonderful facilities, other than accumulating its endowment, and its fundraising goals. Other than maintaining 31 clinical operations with one, at least one full-time staff, and the Appleseed Electoral Project now has a full-time lawyer, what else? Can it be suggested that the Harvard Law School should take the lead among law schools in helping to establish universally accessible institutions of systemic justice in our country? Where would civil liberties be today in our country without the ACLU? And if you don't disagree with the ACLU, it's not the ACLU. Where would the civil rights movement be in this country without those valiant people who were beaten up in the South and elsewhere and became plaintiffs in cases that were able to be brought by Thurgood Marshall, who was the chief attorney for the NAACP? Where would the civil rights legacy of Supreme Court victories be without those institutions? Harvard Law School likes to say that it sends out to the world highly trained and skilled lawyers. Let me remind you what Jean Monnet once said, one of the founders of the European Common Market. Just a citizen, he had no official portfolio. He said, without people, nothing is possible. Without institutions, nothing is lasting. It's not enough just to graduate people. It's not enough just to graduate people with wide horizons. It's not enough just to graduate people who believe the pursuit of happiness inextricably involves the pursuit of justice and vice versa, that the pursuit of justice is very much part of one's pursuit of happiness. What needs to be extended is the prestige and status of the Harvard Law School, some of it unmerited, into the extension with other law schools of reducing the farce of the law, the tragedy of the law, the exclusivity of the law, the servile function of the law in concentrating power and its abuses in our society. The function of the law that serves more as a tool against the people, that serves against the people in terms of delay and attrition, the misuse or the use of the law that services the few to dominate the many. So I suggest that perhaps out of this evening, we place on the topic of debate at the law school that the purpose of the Harvard Law School is to use some of its status and prestige and brain power and its endowment, where it's not restricted, and its unrestricted fundraising ability in the future, to help establish institutions of systemic justice that advance procedural due process, a very, very important thousand-year contribution to humanity that needs to be available to all, and substantive justice in engineering areas, medical areas, governance areas, poverty areas, in all the roles that we play as voters, citizens, taxpayers, consumers, workers, small investors, savers, in all the areas where injustice has been documented ad nauseum and still awaits the remedies, the foreseeing and the forestalling that is law at their highest, highest performance. When we met with our class of 58, 35th reunion, and you'll have that reunion with your class, we resolved to do something different and come back to law school, write checks, and be regaled by the dean. We couldn't agree on anything because most of my classmates were corporate lawyers. How to get us all together was a challenge. We agreed on one principle, uniquely articulated in the Harvard Law tradition. There is not too much justice in America. So we started with that agreement. And then we resolved to establish with our own funding the Appleseed Foundation. Richard Parker is a director. Appleseed Foundation, which had one function, which is to hire young lawyer graduates and have them go out around the country and rustle up the conscience of attorneys and have them spend some time being lawyers in the furtherance of justice in their areas, and start Appleseed Centers for Law and Justice, individual 501c3s with their own board of directors, but adhering to a central core of standards established by the National Appleseed. We now have 15 underway. Some of them, most of them are quite small, but they'll get larger. We have some clinical projects underway with law schools, one here at Harvard on electoral change reform, and one at AU Law School on the same subject. And we hope to have others on antitrust, intellectual property, et cetera, various other law schools. It's one thing to urge you to be public interest lawyers, and you have a very good public interest placement office here. In some years, it seems to be underutilized. But it's another thing not to have the opportunities there for a decent standard of living on your part. And we think it's our responsibility of our generation to help expand the number of public interest lawyers. You know, there are 800,000 lawyers in the United States. Do you know how many public interest lawyers there are full-time? You know, defined as they come to work every day and they pursue what they think is important. They're not client-driven so much as driven by their own sense of what they want to correct. About 550. When you think what they have accomplished, just in the environmental area, a fraction of that number, it gives you heart. We're not talking about legal services now, the government-supported dwindling program. We're talking about groups like NRDC, ACLU full-time lawyers, Urban League lawyers, consumer group lawyers, etc. Now, just imagine if when you come out of law school, come out with minimal debt, you're flush with enthusiasm to make your mark on the world, to bring your conscience in tandem every day with your talents, and to pursue systemically what your intellect favors you in pursuing the advancement of justice in a society, not palliatively, but systemically. To deal with the reallocation of resources, which are often an insane inversion of priorities in our country, rich country, country with huge GNP, huge corporate profits, huge stock market prices, with 25% child poverty, 80% of the bottom rung of the workers making less inflation adjusted than they made 20, 25 years ago, massive consumer debt, 48 million people, including children, without health insurance, the only country in the Western world without universal coverage, crumbling public works, huge consumer debt, record personal bankruptcies. One of your professors has been properly crusading on that issue for years. What's wrong here? What's wrong is we've accepted corporate yardsticks as a measure of economic progress instead of people yardsticks. And who better than attorneys acting as lawyers in a systemic way to demystify the process and raise the sights and lead and help valiant community groups and other repressed populations into a society worthy of our commendation. Land of the free, home of the brave. Really now, what kind of content is there in that when it comes to the supra-governance of multinational corporations, sidestepping our courts, creating their private legislatures, and basically assaulting democracy at every juncture? These large corporations transcending national jurisdictions are simply not compatible with democracy and democratic processes. And one of their major recent exhibits was the GATT-NAFTA trade agreements, which almost no legislator read. I met no one in the U.S. government who read it at any high levels of decision making, including President Clinton, Vice President Gore. We held a prize out for any member of Congress. We'd contribute $10,000 to their favorite charity if they could sign an affidavit that they'd read the 500-page GATT agreement and would answer 10 simple questions about it in public. We got one taker after a second extension of the deadline. It was Senator Hank Brown, Republican of Colorado. He had voted for NAFTA. He read all 500 pages, sequestered the Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting room for the examination. Dick Goodwin from my class and I went. We sat with the senators. He sat where the witnesses are. All the TV was around it. We hurled 12 questions at him, and he answered all 12. Everybody clapped in the audience, and then he said, I have another comment to make. I said, certainly, Senator. It's your privilege. It's your room. He said, I voted for NAFTA, and I was going to vote for GATT. But after reading the entire trade agreement, I realized it was so antagonistic to democratic processes that I'm going to vote against it. And as far as we know, he's the only person in the U.S. Congress in a split vote who read that document. And we looked to the law schools for support, and with few exceptions, nothing. And that's true again and again. You can't go through law school without involving yourself in some noble pursuit of justice. If only for the memories. If only for the absence of regret. It was Dean Griswold who wrote an article in Harvard Law Review when he left in the late 60s. You might look it up. He said, what is it that we bring to our law school first-year law students who are so idealistic, and when they graduate, they're so much less than that? You know, there have been books and articles written on that. They're trying to explain it. When else, fresh, eager, and then it begins to decline. They become pragmatic. They become cynical. They become forward-looking to the next law firm interview. Here's what happens. You're taught to argue any side of the question. And you're taught that you're entitled to argue any side of the question, and you draw a wrong conclusion, many of you. Namely that it really doesn't count. It's just who can make the best argument. That's the way lawyers operate. Who's got the best lawyer? With the most clever argument. It tends to denature your normative sensitivities. The second is, your professors are not raising the horizons enough. They're not aggressive enough. They're too conducive to taking you as you are. They need to shake you up more. They need to make you more than you think you are. They need to make you absorb a higher estimate of your own significance in life. They need to counteract the technical specialization that gives you a tunnel vision over the next 50 years. And then, of course, there is the clinical experience that makes you feel almost futile. Yeah, you represent these clients, you help them a little bit, but everyone you represent, there seems to be five more, and there's no end to it. And you get a kind of a burnout or a sense of futility. And then here comes the rationalization of futility, which is, I can do more as a member of a large law firm. To be sure, I'll have to represent some companies I don't particularly like, but I'll get my calls returned. I'll be able to call on some senior partners. When I become a partner, I'll just be more influential. And there are other things you want to be sensitive to, since most of you are 1Ls. Don't let it happen to you. And one way you can avoid it is to read on the side. And look, you've got time to read on the side. I mean, don't let them make you think that law school is a round-the-clock operation, where you've got to underline the case books, you know, underline now, learn it later, you know. You'll be a better law student if you go over and hear some anthropology lectures or some lectures on molecular biology or the economics, or go up and ask some questions in the business school classes. You know, these are the classes where they have the escalated lecture rooms, you know, like this, and the professor's in the well. And if you're a visitor, you have to look up at the students, which is about the only time you're in a position to look up to the students. Go over there and shake them up. If you're taking a double degree, write for the record. Write for other publications that don't require 50% footnote levels. Go down to Boston. Go to Cambridge, where the poor hang out. Go with some police on their rounds if they let you. Go down, talk to some of the labor union guys. Invite them to sit in your labor union course, your labor law course. You know, have that set, six or seven sprinkled throughout. Think what they would do listening to how you're taught labor law. They might say, well, it doesn't really work that way. Or, gee, I didn't know that we had these rights under collective bargaining. Our union never told us about this. In short, give yourself an opportunity to recognize an opportunity and have an impact on the law school. Your great legacy here in your short time you're here is to hand a cumulative rumble of change for constructive purposes to your students who follow you, number one, so they don't have to reinvent the wheel or get themselves up again and levels of energy they're not experienced with. And second, to examine the resources of the law school and see how they can begin with other law schools, and Harvard's taking the lead on other things, and law schools, a lot of law schools follow, in establishing institutions of justice in one unpioneered area, one unplowed area of our national and global society after another. We would be very pleased with our lawyers, many of whom are graduates from here and other places, to help out. I'm sure there are law students here who are on the cutting edges of trying to do something in that regard. You will revolutionize the legal system in this country. When I took Property One here at Harvard, we studied an estate called the Black Estate. It was a prototype estate of $1 million, big money in those days. And because it was a $1 million estate, it had a lot of complexities to it. And that's what we cut our teeth on in part of that course. We went through that entire course, took the exam, and went on to other things without knowing a single thing about the probate system in America, which was maladministered, looted, gouged in terms of small estates. That is, we learned how to construct an estate plan for the rich, and who cares about the 95% of the rest of the people? You can develop institutions that would fan out all over the country in this respect, and the rate of change will stun you. Many of you have demoralized yourself from taking on big challenges. What's the use? You can't change it. It's too overwhelming. How many times I've heard that word? Too overwhelming. Well, if law students are overwhelmed, what do you think other students are going to be? The ones you want to ally yourselves with. Let me put it down in concrete ways. We have a sign-up sheet out there. It's called, What is the Purpose of Harvard Law School? That'll be the sign-up. Sean, are you here? Anyway, it's out there. Out there, by the way, are some handouts that you might be interested in that are available for you. Sign up there, and if you want to have summer fellowships in this area to further this after your first year and get it ready for your second year, or second for third, if you want to have a variety of facilities, we'll be there to help. We're going to turn this giant ship of Harvard Law School around so they can go down in history as one of the greatest instruments of justice and systemic stamina and institution building of any group in the United States. And we've got to do it by more than concerned students, by serious students. And it will not be done without a critical mass of students doing it. Now, if there isn't a sign-up sheet there, and there should be, Raj will easily get a sign-up sheet to find those of you who will get this underway. I ask you only to take on faith one assertion, that the rate of change to foresee and forestall the tragedies and the injustices that are coming to this world and to deal with the horrific injustices that plague billions of people in this world can be accelerated immensely by a reinvigorated profession stimulated by the law students of this country and reverberating onto the laws and into the institution building that doesn't have to use the law all the time to prevail. 350 of the wealthiest people on this planet have assets equal to the bottom 3 billion. 8,000 people a day die from tuberculosis and malaria. The former was curable in the 1950s. It takes $30 in medicines to cure a tubercular victim in the third world. It's not being done. All over the world, there is more destitution, more starvation, more disease, more mayhem. And we have a modern technological world with huge capital resources and unbelievable feasibilities. Unbelievable feasibilities. We can eliminate tuberculosis in 20 years, just killing 2 million people a year, with the amount of money needed to build 2 B-2 bombers out of the 10 that Congress has appropriated, which the Pentagon no longer wants. And those of you who've read Buckminster Fuller, in terms of the minimal resources to provide clean drinking water, adequate nutrition, shelter, and health care, it's less than 1 month's expenditure on arms in the world, for everyone who needs it in the world. And when you go into your law firm, you want to ask yourself, are you going to be able to say no to clients that corrode and demean your conscience? Corporate clients, not unpopular individuals, that's another obligation entirely. Are you going to be able to say no, or are you going to get along by going along, because that's the sycophant way up toward the partner ladder? If you need help in saying no, find out where you can get help. But I want to ask you, if you were a young associate and you went into a corporate law firm years ago, let's say in the 20s and 30s, would you have taken this assignment? Young law associate, graduate of Harvard Law School, would you please proceed, the senior partner says to you, to create, to draft the broad form deed, the notorious broad form deed, by which the coal companies obtained from the impoverished and desperate Appalachian rural people, for 50 cents per acre, the right to all coal, oil, gas, metals, minerals, the right to divert and pollute water, and immunity from all liability. Would you say yes to that? Would you say yes if they said, would you represent the tobacco industry in further extending their hegemony as the most powerful drug dealers in America? Would you say yes to companies that asked you to draft a binding arbitration provision that no one would understand or see, millions of consumers, that take away their constitutional rights for their day in court, upheld by too many courts? Would you damage the tax equity laws for a cheap retainer and damage it for all other similarly situated tax loophole gropers? Would you defeat the criminal sanction in the Motor Vehicle Safety Act for willful and knowing violation of life-saving standards on behalf of 3 auto companies when you knew, even if you believed those companies would never criminally violate the law, which they have since, when you knew that thousands of other companies here and abroad, auto parts manufacturers, dealers, importers, etc., would come under that immunity? How far would you go? When would you say no? At what time would you think you had other alternatives? Well, I suggest if there was a broad dimension of public interest law and civic institutions, you would never have to confront those choices, because you'd have other generic choices in which to deploy your time, talent, and conscience. Let me just thank you for your patience and indicate that there are a lot of things I know going on here in active way at the law school that I haven't mentioned. Trying to improve the loan repayment plan, this report you might have seen, and struggling for other kinds of discriminatory injustice. The big challenge for law students is not discriminatory injustice. They're quite aware of racial, gender, other kinds of discriminatory injustice. The great challenge is indiscriminate injustice that affects all people, regardless of where they're coming from, like global warming, or arms proliferation, or the dead hand of corrupt bureaucracies. I hope that you will commit yourself to this essential new venture in reassessing the purpose of the Harvard Law School with full attention to all the nuances and all the likely riposte by well-honed minds that want the status quo to persist. When I was here, I saw the Harvard Law School as an island of immense legal resource in an urban setting of decay and injustice. Let's make sure that in the future, the law school becomes the luminous source of enlightenment and proper attention to priorities to build structures of justice that will work, that will refine themselves in the future, and it will be emulated all around the world with due cultural differentiations. I don't think that's too ambitious. I think we have to raise the ante in terms of what is possible. The law school has never been richer. It's never been fuller of facilities. It's never had more alumni willing to do something else than send a check, willing to have their intelligence tapped to collaborate with faculty, teachers, and themselves. Let's see how you respond. You are the acorn. You are the acorn for the oak tree. There will be a lot of nutrients once the acorns are planted. You are the acorns. Let's see how many acorns sign up. And we'll certainly be back to you. Thank you. Thank you very much.